Hello and welcome to The Convex Conversation, a brand new podcast series hosted by me, journalist and broadcaster Helen Fospero. Over the last year, I've spent a lot of time filming with the Red Arrows. I grew up in Lincolnshire, where they're based, so it's been great getting to know the pilots and engineers, and a real privilege to be behind the scenes at RAF Scampton. One of the most fascinating things I've learned is that their breathtaking displays are all done on voice intonation. Well, that was Squadron Leader Martin Pert, recorded in the cockpit of his Hawk during training. It's Pert's voice which the RAF's nine-strong aerobatic team rely on when they're in the air. Perty is Red One, the team leader, a position you have to be invited back to take, and only once you've completed 3 years as a Red Arrows pilot. Leadership, trust and tenacity are all key to this unique role. Perty, thanks for taking some time out of what I know will be a packed day at Scampton. Let's start, if we may, with that special role of Red One. What does it entail?
Good afternoon, Helen. The role of Red One is really the figurehead for the team, and it's my role to completely choreograph the display that we're going to fly for a year. But actually, much more importantly than that, it's to lead every single one of those eight pilots wherever the Red Arrows go airborne, be that taking off from our home base, Scampton, transiting to our local airfields, or even taking the team across the world to put on those displays. So it goes much more than just leading an aerobatic formation display. It's also heading up, you know, a band of eight very talented individuals and getting them from A to B.
So just explain how you use your voice to lead and guide the other eight pilots when you're displaying.
I'll start off. Obviously, these are very experienced military pilots who are well versed in the art of formation flying. So to them, flying in formation is not a new skill. What is a new skill for them, though, is trying to make it look like we're one graceful, locked together, welded wing, as we call it. And the only way we can do that is by timing the inputs to the controls to absolute perfection. And the only way they can time that is with some sort of reference, and that reference is my voice. So absolutely every input I put on the controls, I have to reference with my voice so that there's a timestamp that they can adhere to. And that's very simple. You know, a left turn, for example, very simple to do, but actually what I do is vocalize it. So just to come left simply becomes a coming left now. And with that intonation and with that rhythmic cadence, the guys get very used to having that timestamp, and then they also know what inputs to make with their own aircraft.
You're famous for the red, white and blue smoke, which also comes on with your voice command. But that also has a safety role, doesn't it?
It's wonderful to have the power to be able to put on the red, white and blue whenever I wish. But absolutely, that is also done to precise command, because otherwise, clearly, it would look pretty sloppy. So we want this to look neat. We want it to look regimented. And the way that we do that is, again, using my voice as that timestamp. So I just simply call for colour on, go. And the guys know exactly which colour they're going to put on at which stage, because that comes into the briefing. But actually, above all of that and the aesthetics and the visual appeal of having that smoke is the safety aspect. It's absolutely critical that in a display where we're travelling at times up to 8 miles a minute, that we have some sort of visual acuity tool that allows us to pick each other up. And the best way to do that is by streaming white smoke out the back of the aircraft so that you've actually got a historical trail, and therefore much easier for the guys to be able to pick out those aircraft when they could be 6-7 miles away.
You're flying very fast, often very close, up to speeds of around 350 miles an hour. Yet the pilots are all focused on your Hawk, aren't they?
Absolutely. So when we're a nine-ship formation, all locked into that formation with those turns that are choreographed as I described before, every single one of those pilots, even the one who's furthest back or the furthest out on the right, is staring at my aircraft. He's not looking at the aircraft that's next to him. He's trying to ignore that aircraft and almost look through it to my aircraft and the references that he's then triangulating those points so that he can get some sort of formation reference from my jet so that he knows whether he's in the right or ultimately the wrong place.
And give us a sense of what it feels like for you as a fast jet pilot when you're up in the air doing those displays. I mean, presumably the focus has to be razor sharp.
every single second of a Red Arrow's flight just saps absolutely every bit of concentration out of all nine of the display pilots at any one time. All the thoughts about, you know, nerves or just an appreciation of even the pride in the role almost go out of the window as soon as we get into the cockpit, because it's about safety, clearly, primarily. But it's also about putting on the best display we can at every single stage of that display, be it the taxi out in formation, be it the takeoff, and then obviously coming together as that nine ship, graceful, flowing, dynamic display that people are so used to seeing. But that ultimately requires every single one of the nine pilots in that formation to be entirely focused on that single job in hand for that 30 or 40 minute sortie.
Practicing the routine is full on, but I know you rehearsed the fly pass, and I suppose when you're flying over somewhere like Buckingham Palace, you have to get it right. What does that feel like for you when you fly down the Mall in front of the other Hawks?
One of the main roles for us is as a national display team to fly past huge events, and there's none more so iconic than usually the fly pass down the Mall and over Buckingham Palace where the Queen's watching. But what looks like a simple straight and level, wings level flypast are usually charged with the most adrenaline for us as the pilots, because there's such a huge amount of pressure to get that right. You know how many people are watching, be it down there on the Mall or on television at home, and you know that the timing is so precise that from the second we even start briefing, we're on that timeline. We're leaving Scampton, we're trying to get down to London, which is about 200 miles away, to the exact second over Buckingham Palace. So what on paper looks very straightforward very quickly becomes one of the most complex tasks in aviation.
The pressure must be extraordinary knowing that Her Majesty's watching.
It's always amazing knowing that the Queen is going to be down there watching, and you just don't know what the reaction's going to be like that she's going to give you. But you also know how many other people there are down there watching as well, and just expecting that flypast or that parade to be closed up by the Red Arrows streaming red, white and blue. And if we get it wrong, it's such a public stage to get it wrong on.
The Queen's a big Red Arrows fan. What was it like when you and the team met her informally recently at Windsor Castle? And what did she say to you when she came in?
We've been very privileged to be able to meet Her Majesty the Queen on a number of occasions, the most recently of which was a very private occasion with her. And you can just see the way that she reacts to us and the questions that she asks. She's intimately involved in what we do. She knows to the second what our schedule is. And I think she just gets a grasp of the pressure that we feel representing her on a national and international stage, but also, you know, a real sense of pride, which just gives us that real warm feeling that it's not just the British public that love the Red Arrows. It's also, you know, it's the big boss, it's Her Majesty, and she really holds us quite dear to her heart, I believe.
I gather she had a few snaps of you in her handbag.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. We were there just sort of having drinks with her, and it was a sort of late lunch for about an hour and a half, and very relaxed, very informal, no other visitors there apart from us, the team and the Queen. And she was talking about, you know, the number of fly paths she's seen us do over the years that she's been in charge. And all of a sudden she sort of reached into her handbag and thought, oh, we're going to be able to get an insight into what's in the Queen's handbag here. And she pulled out a 6x4 sort of snappy snaps, home printed photograph of the team flying over Windsor Castle that one of her great granddaughters had taken and then given to her as a bit of a gift. And she was so beaming and so pleased and just full of smiles at the fact that we got straight over the top of Windsor Castle with the red, white and blue streaming. And I've been dining out on the fact that the Queen keeps a picture of me in her handbag ever since.
Bertie, we've filmed together quite a lot over the last year, including for the One Show on BBC One, but we've never really had time to talk about what made you want to become a fast jet pilot in the first place. What's your story?
What's my story? Yeah, how did I get into aviation? I've been intrigued and enthralled by aviation since a really young age. I was quite lucky to live behind an old Rolls-Royce aerodrome that in my youth was way up and functioning, and it had different aircraft coming in every single day, be it Spitfires, you know, private jets, and even we had Concorde coming to do sort of touch and goes on occasion back in the day. So I think the first seed corn was from just watching those aeroplanes, like most young people, just that wonder of how on earth these things can fly and this, you know, big ball of metal. And from there, I just sort of dug into what got people inspired and how these people who flew these aeroplanes got to that stage. And that led me down a number of paths, one of which was the Air Cadets, which I joined. Another of which was working at a local aerodrome, just pumping fuel into aircraft at the age of 16 and pulling them around for the private owners and being paid back in kind with the odd flying lesson here or there. And before I could even drive, I'd been solo in an aircraft, applied for various scholarships and sponsorships and was very lucky in being successful in those applications. And one thing led to another. And, you know, as a young boy, my interest had always been in the really fast aircraft and the pointy sort of fighter jets. And applying to the Air Force seemed like the absolutely logical conclusion to that, to be presented with the opportunity to fly these things. And here I am 20 years later, sitting as Red One, having been in the military for that long, having had an absolutely outstanding career to date.
And with your photograph in the Queen's handbag.
And with a picture of me in the Queen's handbag. So I probably need to go out on a high and quit and go and become a, you know, do a desk job somewhere, because, you know, I do pinch myself every day, and not one of us on the Red Arrows takes any of the job for granted, which A, you can't for safety reasons, but B, I think you'd be in the wrong job if you did. And every single minute of my career has just been pretty high octane. It's been exciting. I've been around the world a number of times. You know, I really did join up to fly aircraft, but I've done everything in between as well. And it's been hugely, you know, privileged and proud moments throughout every single minute of those 20 years.
I'm going to make you blush now, because I know you reasonably well, and you will blush. You instructed on the Hawk, and that means you are known as a creamy. What does that mean?
Yeah, creamy is one of those classic military. We've got terms that we have in conversation that might not make sense to, you know, to anyone else if they were to overhear them. So creamies are a prime example of that. It stretches back to, you know, milk deliveries and milk bottles and people talking about the cream being the best bit and you cream off the top there. The reason for that is I went through flying training as a student, like every other flying training student in the Royal Air Force. But they have a system where they will take people from the top of that instructional cadre, those people who they've been training, and keep them back to be instructors themselves. So I went through my fast jet training, and before I was even posted to the front line to get some frontline experience, they kept me back to teach my peers how to fly fast jets, which seems completely perverse in any other environment, but is actually wholly relied upon in the military.
And was that something you enjoyed? Or did you feel perhaps frustrated at the time because you were ready to begin frontline duties?
As a 23-year-old going through flying training in northwest Wales and Anglesey, which, beautiful part of the world, but as a 23-year-old singly is pretty remote part of the world, I remember feeling absolutely gutted at the time. Clearly, a sense of pride that they deemed me suitable to be an instructor at that stage and so early on in my career. But I remember feeling pretty dejected, especially when I then saw all of my oppos, my peers, disappearing off to the front line to do the job that we joined up to do, which was to fly Harriers and to fly Tornadoes and Jaguars, and just to get into those cockpits, let alone to then go off and do, you know, the things that we're expected to do with them. So mixed feelings at the time, and it certainly stood me in great stead for the rest of my career. But if I were to go back to that day there and sort of remember feeling that feelings of dejectedness and disappointment, it was pretty raw.
I'm sure it was. You did eventually fly the Harrier and other aircraft on frontline operations. Mm. Can you share with us one of your most memorable assignments or sorties?
I was lucky enough to fly the Harrier, which is just a piece of British ingenuity in itself. And just the engineering that went into that aircraft and the versatility that it could be utilised for, you know, landing on a boat one day and then the very next day going to land in a small clearing in a wood somewhere, you know, close to the German border, or, you know, then the next day sort of flying at night low level through the valleys of Wales. Just every single part of flying that aircraft was remarkable. But I think for any pilot or any probably military operator, it's got to be your first operational mission. And for me, absolutely, my first operational mission over Afghanistan, 6.5 hours of overwatch, you know, making sure that our boys on the ground were being protected and were in as little danger as possible, with us over the top at 16,000 feet in a particularly hostile environment, is definitely one of those sort of clawback memories for me.
You mentioned that hostile environment in Afghanistan, and really the Harrier or the ejection seat saved your life when your plane caught on fire. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, the Harrier itself had a number of vices for a pilot, and it's certainly not a fly-by-wire aircraft, and it's certainly not something that you can ever let your guard down at all. And as a young, inexperienced pilot on that aircraft, one of those vices came to bite me, and we were coming into land at Kandahar in Afghanistan, and my wingman's missile warning system went off, fired some automatic flares out, which is a self-preservation method that the aircraft will do automatically for you. But clearly that then focuses the mind. And at that stage, as a very young and experienced pilot, my focus was quite rightly on working out, was someone trying to shoot at us? Where was it coming from? And how do we get this damn thing on the ground as quickly as possible? And just down to that inexperience and some of those vices, that aircraft did come and bite me. And, you know, I ended up sort of pancaking into the ground in Afghanistan and having to use the ejection seat to get myself out of trouble. Because at that stage, you know, that aircraft was burning, and it was burning pretty vigorously.
Did that ever make you think that perhaps you didn't want to fly anymore? You know, that must be terrifying. I saw the picture on your Instagram when we all posted pictures of what we were up to 10 years ago. And yours did really take the biscuit, Bertie, because you got flames coming out of your seat and you're sort of heading northwards into the sky. On a sort of serious note, was it a frightening experience and one that you thought might stop your career?
Yeah, without wanting to sound, you know, automaton about this, the scariest bit of that entire sequence was actually coming down in the parachute, because an ejection sequence is almost entirely automatic. After you've pulled the ejection handle, you're along for the ride. And the only bit I remember feeling, you know, abject fear about was the rate at which I was descending under that parachute. Now, in training, we're told you're coming down quickly. This is not a sports parachute. You're not doing a tandem skydive, you know, at your local sort of airfield for charity. This thing's coming down at 22 feet per second. It's like jumping off a double-decker bus. But I remember just feeling at the time, this is going too quickly and I'm going to do myself some serious damage here, if not, you know, more so. So that really, in the whole sequence of events, was the only time that I remember ever feeling fearful or frightened or, you know, scared, to want of a better word. The rest of it was more just process. You know, it was just, this is what I've been trained to do. It's not gone well here. I've also been trained how to get out of trouble, pull the ejection seat handle, and, you know, a blind bit of faith in what is also a piece of amazing British technology in the Martin Baker ejection seat, and it'll be all right. And thankfully, it was absolutely fine. You then have a period of enforced layoff. I had 3.5 months off. I'd broken two of the vertebrae in my back. And you get a lot of time to reflect on how it's gone and what might have gone wrong and what you can do about that and whether it is appropriate for you to then get back in the cockpit. But I'll tell you, I think I probably knew that I was definitely in the right career, because by the day, you know, the 3.5 month point came round, I was absolutely itching to get back in that cockpit.
But to be able to serve your country on the front line, flying fast jets, to mere mortals like me is something pretty special. What does it take, do you think, to make a great fast jet pilot?
Yeah, I think you're right. Not many fast jet pilots think about what goes into making a fast jet pilot. We're quite lucky in the Red Arrows in that we do have quite a strict selection procedure where we do actually look at these questions. We look at what certainly makes a Red Arrows team pilot, which in itself comes out of what makes a good fast jet fighter pilot. I think that there's kind of three things that the guys that we're looking for into the team need. The first one of which is patience. We need to have seen that they can be patient, because what you cannot do in an aircraft when things are going wrong is rush. You cannot jump to conclusions. You cannot, you know, pluck out the first thing that you think of and use that as your solution to any of the problems that you might be faced with. So patience, where appropriate, obviously understanding that sometimes we're going 7 or 8 miles a minute, it doesn't give you that much time, but you definitely need that. I think the next one's tenacity. You have to be able to work hard from day one of officer training into flying training, into the front line where you never stop training. Even when you're in operations, you debrief every sortie for a good hour, hour and a half, trying to establish what could have been done better. They're still training sorties, even though you're on operations. And you need to have the tenacity to be able to work hard, learn from your mistakes and apply them to every single sortie. And that is absolutely transferable to the Red Arrows, because we're trying to make each display better than the last one. And I think the last one really is just the ability to take criticism. You know, it's the ability to be able to debrief professionally, have somebody tell you that you've done something wrong and why you've done it wrong and potentially how you could do it better. And wipe any personality or, culture clashes out the window and apply that wholeheartedly to the next time you go and do it, be it on operations, be it on a Red Arrows training sortie, or be it just through flying training when you're trying to do your aerobatics for the first time. And you can't, there's no saving face here. This is not about trying to look good all the time. You need to be able to take that criticism. So, yeah, I think those 3 points, which we look for in Red Arrows pilots, are completely applicable to what makes a good fighter pilot in the Air Force.
Well, to even be considered to become a Red Arrow, you have to have a minimum of 1,500 hours flying fast jets and come from a frontline squadron. So one would presume that all applicants are capable of learning to do the aerobatics. But how important, Purty, is teamwork as a Red and fitting in?
You're absolutely right. You know, the prime thing we need is that the guys can do the flying job. And we have a very rigorous procedure for that. We put them through a flying test that will absolutely identify any weaknesses. And we're looking for a learning curve. We're not looking for them to be perfect. We're looking for them to take that critique I mentioned, apply it to the next routine that they do, and show some level of improvement with a learning curve that's relatively steep. But you're right, this is a team, you know, and we're called a team for a really good reason, because it's not just about 9 guys flying individually in their own box of airspace, trying to put on the best display that they can as an individual. We're utilising each other's strengths and, you know, to a degree, weaknesses to be able to put on that best display. That's not just confined to the air. We have an ambassadorial role, whether it be in the science, technology, engineering and maths arena with school children, you know, schools outreach programs, discovery centers, museums, question and answers online, you know, even more so than ever. And to be able to do that as an individual is hard enough, but to be able to do that as a team can sometimes be even more challenging. So we do absolutely need people that we're going to live in each other's pockets with for 9, 10, 11 months of the year, who can get on, who can face-to-face criticise one another, step out of the debriefing room and completely depersonalise that and leave those points in the briefing room and carry on as teammates, as team colleagues, you know, I can't sort of stress enough how important that is for the cohesion of something like the Red Arrows. We're an elite unit. We're kept to our own devices at RAF Scampton. We train 3 times a day with each other, and we have very little other distractions. We need to be able to get on with one another, because then we need to be able to portray that as the face of the Royal Air Force and the United Kingdom as a whole when we go overseas.
When you've whittled your applicants down to the last 8 or 9, how do you put them through their paces in that last week or so to choose the right new pilots?
Yeah, so we tend to get an application process takes us from about 30 pilots down to 8 or 9 pilots, and we take them away with us for our training, spring training camp, which is usually done overseas somewhere in sunnier climes whilst the weather's not great in the UK. We take them with us. They live residentially with us for a week. We take them on the flying test, as already alluded to. They have an interview. We take them out on formal functions, be it at the ambassador's residence, where we're generally meeting local dignitaries, or just simply, you know, around the officer's mess or where we're staying. But also there's a social aspect to it. We need to be able to see what they're like as peers, because we're quite blessed in that we have a peer review system. And whilst the flying and the interview and those formal aspects of the selection process are the most important, very close second comes that teamwork dynamic that we require from each of those individuals. So it's pretty rigorous, you know, and it's a tiring week. They're flying three times a day, which they might not do on the front line. Most frontline units fly three, maybe four times a week if you're lucky. Flying three times a day, five times a week is pretty tiring. Then you add on top of that the pressure of being in that selection process where we're looking for only generally two, maybe three pilots out of those nine. You know, and that's a pretty low success rate, really. And the guys feel the pressure on that selection process.
Leadership, of course, is vital in your role, and also trust must be key, and not just trust with the other pilots.
Trust is one of the words that just binds absolutely everyone here together. And it isn't just the pilots. It's not just the nine display pilots. It's absolutely everyone involved with the Royal Air Force aerobatic team, the Red Arrows. It's the engineers who are servicing these aircraft three or four times a day to make them airworthy for us to fly. It's for, you know, the new pilot, Red 2, who's only been doing this job for 6 months, to be able to trust that what he's being told by Red 9, who's been in the Red Arrows for 6 years, is absolutely correct. And he can swear by the advice that he's been given. And then it comes down to, you know, those points out on the ground. You know, when we're engaging with youth, when we're in these STEM events, it's just the trust that what he has said over there marries up with the same line that we're giving, so that we're not giving out wrong information, or we're not portraying the wrong aspects of the Royal Air Force or the United Kingdom. So absolutely, trust binds every single one of us together in this team.
And how do you think your leadership skills have developed, not just as Red One, but in other positions in the team?
As a Red Arrows pilot, having been on the team for 3 years previously, back in 2012, as a team pilot, as Reds 2, 4 and 8 respectively, I would say my leadership probably didn't get exercised particularly, particularly much during that time. It was just, that was a time of followership mainly, and just getting stuck into the job and learning the role in hand. But certainly, having come back as the team leader, it is got to be the biggest office simulator that you could ever ask for. Every single day I'm presented with a new challenge, which is not necessarily just keeping this team up and running, but it's about displaying traits that people can follow on from. You know, I'd like to try and lead by example. I'm not an autocrat. I do tell people where to go when we're flying because that is my job. But on the ground, I like to lead more by example. This is how I construct my life, my daily plan. This is how I expect you to construct yours. And as long as they lie somewhere in the middle, we're probably on a reasonably even keel. You know, I've been presented with some of the most difficult challenges I've ever faced in my 20-year military career in the last 2 years to 18 months. And it's amazing. It's an amazing display of human resilience, because it's just remarkable to see what people can get away with and what they can do when they just apply themselves with a bit of ingenuity to achieve a task that on paper looks absolutely impossible. And actually, when we've achieved it, then that moment of backslapping has finished and being able to debrief to it, you realize that that is probably the best way we could have ever skinned that cat. Is just remarkable.
You skinned a rather large cat at the end of last year, Percy, when you embarked on your 11-week tour of North America, visiting around 40 different locations and displaying literally to millions of people. That trip must have presented lots of challenges, not least flying over the icy waters of the Greenland Strait. Mm-hmm. Presumably your leadership skills were tested to the limit.
We took 12 aircraft all the way to the west coast of the States, and these are not airline aircraft. You know, these aircraft have got about a two-hour fuel endurance, which means you can't get all that far before you need to land and refuel. And if you're trying to transit 700 or 800 miles of frozen water, or, you know, 3-degree water, which will give you about a 20-minute survival time if you end up in it, is a tricky ask. And you know, I've got some experienced military aviators there who know that that is a risky business. This is probably some of the riskiest flying they will have done, notwithstanding some of the inhospitable kind of areas they've been in operations. So that was a huge leadership challenge. And it, again, came from leading by example. And I can't give every single answer. there's no way that I can have a solution up my sleeve for everything that we're presented with on a second-by-second basis when we're flying, on an hour-by-hour basis when we're planning, or a week-by-week basis when we're sort of contingency, execution of contingency plans. But I realise that doesn't matter, because it's how you react at the time that most people take your leadership skills from. It's how do you react to that situation? How do you react as a leader to being presented with that significant piece of information? Or how do you react as a leader to this risk? And do you balance it appropriately? And if so, that in itself tends to be the way that I run my team, and also how I found the most success out of those people that I lead.
And there were some fantastic highlights of that tour. I mean, I'm thinking of the image of you all flying over the Golden Gate Bridge, flying past the Hollywood sign, displaying with other aerobatic teams in the States.
Yeah.
What were the standout moments for you?
So we knew on paper that this was going to present some of the most fantastic Red Arrows images, you know, in the team's history. And I knew as a team leader how lucky I was to be leading up the Reds in the year that it's been decided we're going on tour to the United States, the first tour to the States in 11 years and the biggest tour of Red Arrows history. So we knew on paper these were going to be great. And actually, one of the real challenges was making sure that we didn't get ourselves too excited and that we didn't, you know, big these things up so much, because all that then happens is you're still flying over the Golden Gate Bridge, but it ends up being a disappointment because it's not how you expected it to be. What I can say is that every single one of those moments, because we went into it with clarity and because we'd done as much planning as we could, probably far exceeded even our expectations. And just the, you know, the warm, the hospitable ways in which we were met with by air traffic control, by other formation display teams, the US national teams, and pretty much everyone we met out there, and the way that they kind of welcomed us with open arms is what made pretty much every single one of those moments, even the really tricky bits, so stand out. And it's so difficult to pluck out one individual memory. I mean, you've already alluded to it. The Golden Gate Bridge, when you see it from 40 or 50 miles away, and it's not a big bridge, you know, it's no bigger than the Humber Bridge, you know, which is just up the road from us here at RAF Scampton. But when you see that kind of glorious red colour just oozing from 40 miles away, and the Bay Area, which is somewhere I flew around on a very rudimentary flight simulator as an 11-year-old boy, and you recognise it, but you've now got gleaming red aircraft in your mirrors and red, white and blue smoke that just lingers because there's not a breath of wind. What a day that was. And you know, that was a career highlight for me, which was only bettered about 4 hours later with another career highlight when we made our way down to Southern California. So every day had just something, you know, that bettered the day before.
There was something quite lovely being a Lincolnshire lass about seeing the Hawks in the States and Canada. They're so beautiful and relatively old aircraft. Mm. But the rawness always strikes me when I see the jets in the hangar. What are they like to fly, and how fond are you of your Hawks?
I've been lucky enough to fly the Hawks since 2003. And whilst I've moved on to other aircraft since and come back to the Hawk, the thing that is so beautiful about the Hawk is it's incredibly simple as an aircraft. You look in there and yes, there's dials that might to the layman look reasonably confusing, but actually as a pilot, it's probably the minimum number of dials and instruments that you actually need, because the focus is on the flying of that aircraft, and it is just so balanced. It's so harmonized. You know, the power to weight ratio is not extreme, but it's absolutely enough for what we're trying to achieve. And it's, you know, it has excess power, which is something that pilots always want. It's very good at aerobatics. It's incredibly stable as a formation platform, and it's really simple to engineer, which means, touch wood, it goes wrong very, very rarely. So it's got all the hallmarks of something that a pilot wants. Get in, turn it on, fly it, because it's simple, and the flying itself is great fun. So yeah, I'm really fond of this, you know, this 40-year-old now vintage aircraft, which has taken me to some remarkable places.
And when you're not wearing your green flying suit or your red flying suit, you fly for pleasure. I suppose that must take you back to being a 16-year-old boy.
Absolutely. And, I can't delete those roots, and I can't, stress enough how much I love aviation, which is a damn good thing that I'm in this job. But my wife does not understand why, when I've finished flying, three or four times a day for 5 or 6 days of the week here in my day job, then at the weekend I leave her again to go and fly small aircraft that are doing about a seventh of the speed that I'm usually used to flying. So, yeah, it doesn't quite make sense, even to me, that the busman's holiday is so enjoyable, but it really is. It's just that pure love of raw flying and just being airborne and having that opportunity. I'm lucky to have that opportunity, and I want to revel in that whilst I am still lucky enough to do so.
I remember you saying to me that when you're flying with the Red Arrows, you're not flying for pleasure. You're working when you're training or doing the display and the routines, and you can't really appreciate flying through the clouds. It must be very different when you're flying a small aircraft.
You're absolutely right, because when I'm at work, it really is focus mode. I'm really absolutely in the moment. And yes, I'm seeing the ground whizzing by at, these 7 miles a minute and taking in the odd bit here or there, but it's not enjoyment. There's no time to enjoy it. That's the downside of this job, is that I get to see these views, but I don't enjoy it until much, much later when I'm sort of reflecting on what we've been doing. Whereas when I get into a Cessna or, a little Piper, I can enjoy it at the time and really sort of revel in the fact that we're going slow enough to be able to look at the swimming pools and people's back gardens and enjoy the view of the cliffs and, see the seaside. Things that, yes, I can see from the cockpit of a Red Arrow's Hawk, but there's about a million other things I'm thinking about at that time.
Being a Red Arrow makes you part of one of the world's smallest and indeed exclusive clubs. It's your last season in the Reds, Purty. What next?
It's always going to be a difficult come down, having been a Red Arrows pilot, especially as Red One. And clearly there's a number of options available to anyone who's been in that world before, the primary one of which is to just remain in aviation and talk about that love of aviation and the experiences that we've had, because this lives with a pilot forevermore. They've done this job. They're not kicked out of the club. Yep, they're kicked out of the team, but they're still within a very, elite, select band of individuals who've done it. And I think most of us just revel in the pride and the ability to be able to portray that to whoever asked the questions, be it, the young who are interested in aviation or space or, that industry or the STEM arenas, or just your old mate down the pub who wants to swing the lamp and talk about that time that you were leading the team over the Golden Gate Bridge.
And I'm sure when you're in your 90s, you'll be still telling people that the Queen had a picture of you in her handbag.
You're damn right I will.
Will they believe you, though? That's the question, Purty. It's been a real pleasure chatting to you. I knew it would be. I could actually carry on all day, as there's so many more things I'd love to ask. But thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Helen.
I know there isn't a lot of downtime at Scampton, so I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Lovely to talk to you.
That was Squadron Leader Martin Purt, otherwise known as Red One, the leader of the Red Arrows. Thank you for your company. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast, made specially for Convex. I'll be back with another interesting and inspiring guest soon, so I'll see you then.